News, Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed down more than 100 points to end the day at 27,933. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pajamagram Company, creators of matching holiday pajamas for the whole family, including dogs and cats, with Charlie Brown, Star Wars, and Grinch themes, in knits, fleece, and flannel. Available at pajamagram.com.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Hi, welcome to Trojan Shelter.
Trojan Shelter is the name of LA's newest homeless shelter.
So my name is Esther Cha, and we're currently at Trojan Shelter, which is a homeless shelter for college students run entirely by USC students.
Esther Cha is a 20-year-old junior at USC, majoring in business administration. She and a small group of others from USC are running this place. It's open to any 18 to 25-year-old college student with nowhere else to live. She gave a tour of the Koreatown shelter to KCRW's Danielle Chiraguayo.
So if you follow me into the doorway, you can see on your left, we have a living room, which...
Trojan Shelter is located inside of the rectory at St. Mary's Episcopal Church. This church also allows homeless folks to sleep in their vehicles in its parking lot.
And then on your right, we have the first bedroom, and this is going to be bedroom number one where our residents will stay. It has a really spacious closet. It's personally my favorite room. I think it's adorable. I love the bookshelves that are like installed onto the walls. It just looks like a princess room, and I really like it.
It's a spacious front-facing room with wide windows. The living room opposite has warm yellow walls illuminated by the natural light pouring in. A fireplace awaits a cold day this winter.
This is a three-bedroom house with one bathroom.
The shelter has room for six students in shared bedrooms.
And then if you walk a little bit further, we have our second bedroom on the left. This is our biggest room and probably where most of our residents will be staying. And what we plan to do is have bunk beds in each of these rooms for our residents to really be able to have that dorm experience.
Esther and another student named Abigail Leung got the idea to create this shelter about a year and a half ago. They were in an undergraduate public policy class learning about the nonprofit sector. The speaker of that day was the founder of something called the Bruin Shelter. That's a homeless shelter UCLA students started a few years ago to help other students. Cara Esposito, an adjunct faculty member who heads the private Leonetti O'Connell Family Foundation, was teaching the course.
At the conclusion of class, two of my students, Abby and Esther, who had never sat together during class, came up to me and said, "Professor Esposito, we have to open something like this on the east side." And I said, "Of course, if that's something you want to build, I will help you build it." And to be totally frank, I never thought I would hear from them again, because I thought the chances of finding a space in Los Angeles where we could actually build something was non-existent.
But Esther and Abigail came back to Esposito just a few months later. Esposito agreed to be their faculty mentor, and the students explored their options for funding and for staffing. Esposito reached out to the network of USC alumni to pool resources together.
We've just been really touched by how incredibly supportive everyone has been on this issue, which is why I think the long-term goal is to see this model being used all over the place. Why can't alumni let students sleep in extra rooms? Why can't we create systems like this where when students are challenged, we can help quickly?
The shelter today has more than 50 student volunteers to keep it going.
USC has been extraordinary about how can we help. So the dental school, the medical school, the School of Social Work, they've all approached the students from Trojan Shelter to say, "What services do you need? Let us help you." So it really is just getting the infrastructure prepared so that we can have a social worker come every week. We can have dental services provided.
In LA, about one in five community college students are homeless. More than 40% of Cal State University students report that they don't always get the food that they need.
That's just not acceptable. So when you say the homeless and you put quotes around it and you other, it's a mistake, because they're the people who are right next to you, right next to you in the library, right next to you, the students at least, in the classroom, and you have no idea. And that's amazing. But at the same time, we have to help. all of us.
One bathroom. On our left, we have the kitchen where our RAs will be cooking dinner for the residents every night, our RA volunteers. And so
the Trojan Shelter team heard from students in the UCLA Bruin Shelter that they really valued eating together and talking about school.
And what's exciting is when they cook, we're all going to sit together in the living room and eat dinner together as like a family every night. So I think that's like my favorite thing. It really forces us, I guess, to sit down and just relax and put everything aside and just come together and enjoy each other's presence.
So. By starting Trojan Shelter, founders Esther and Abby wanted to provide unhoused college students with a place to live that they can call their own.
We're more of a dorm and student housing than a shelter. We really want to provide a safe place where these students can really do their homework, relax, and get to talk to other students about their midterms, just be normal college students. So that's why we always have two volunteers every night from USC who went through the same training that any RA would go through at USC. So these two volunteers coming in every night will be like the RAs who are just here as moral support.
The team at Children's Shelter wants the community to know that a student-based model with the purpose of helping unhoused folks isn't totally outlandish and could easily be replicated across the country. Here's Charlene Coe, the Director of Resources for Trojan Shelter.
As students, we are seen as, like, we can't really do anything. Like, at this point, we're just going to school and, like, trying to get our own educations. But I think through this model, we're really able to show that as students, we are capable of doing things and we are capable of making changes. And so I'm hoping that, or we're hoping that other college students across the nation can see that and know that they can also do this. And it's not something that's impossible for them.
The first wave of students moved in this weekend, and more will be moving into Children's Shelter on a rolling basis. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's been 7 months since Hollywood writers fired their agents, and the impasse between those writers and agents continues. Hollywood is still working, TV shows and movies are still being made, but at what overall entertainment cost? Are writers still working regular jobs like they always have? What about the people who work with those writers? Have scripted shows and movies suffered in the process? Here to bring us up to speed on the latest is Matt Bellany, who is editorial director over at The Hollywood Reporter. Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
How about a refresher, if you will? Remind us what happened 7 months ago. What was that all about?
Okay, the bird's eye view of this is that the Writers Guild is very upset that talent agencies, which traditionally have made their money off of commissioning their clients, have started to produce their own shows, which means that the talent agency is representing writers while also being technically the employer of those writers. And the Writers Guild finds this to be a conflict. They also don't like the practice of packaging, which is where an agency puts together a whole bunch of talent into a pool, takes it to a network, sells the whole thing, and then gets a percentage of the license fee, which in success can often mean that the agency would make as much or even sometimes more than their client on a show. And the Writers Guild does not like that. They find it a conflict.
So the Writers Guild told its members then to fire those talent agents, right? And that's exactly what happened.
Yes, they said, if we have a new code of conduct, which you have to sign as an agency in order to represent our members, and if you don't sign it, we're going to fire you. Now, the major agencies said, I'm sorry, this is our business, we're not signing this, and they got fired. And a few have come back, the smaller agencies have come back and signed the code of conduct, but the major agencies still are refusing to sign that, and thus, we have this standoff that's in its seventh month.
You're talking about CAA and UTA, the big ones, right, who have not
joined
in.
Yeah, and WME and ICM, the big four, so to speak.
Right, right. From the perspective, Matt, of the people who watch TV, and a lot of people watch TV still, with all the streaming services these days, it seems like there's a lot more TV than there has been in the past. So has anything changed?
Well, things have changed behind the scenes, and there has been a kind of new normal that has settled in. I don't think consumers are going to see it, at least not yet, but the way writers are hired on shows is very different. They're putting themselves up. They're emailing people. They're using their lawyers or their managers, which is putting them in an awkward position. They're trying to use networking, and they're trying to use any means possible to get these jobs. And on the other side, the studios are really having a hard time here because they're used used to getting a steady flow of potential candidates from these agencies, and they're just not getting that now. So they're having to look to alternate means to find writers. And you can debate whether that's having a positive or negative impact. A lot of people say it's a negative impact because these studios depend on agencies to give them new voices and people they may not have heard of before and to really pitch them. And that's not happening as much. So arguably, fewer and less diverse voices are being found. But on the other side, the Guild will say, you know what? We're doing just fine. Our members are getting jobs. They're using their other means to do this. So we're fine. The agents aren't needed.
Is that true, what the Guild is saying? Are writers working?
I think it's a little bit of both. Writers are working. I mean, there is an unprecedented boom right now in scripted television, fueled by what you said. The streaming services all need content, and there's just been an absolute run-up in these jobs for writers. Now, you can argue as to whether they're ultimately benefiting because a lot of these jobs are shorter episodes than traditional shows, but there are jobs out there and writers are finding them. I think if you are an unknown entity and you're trying to break in right now, it's probably more difficult because you don't have that agent whose sole job is to pound the pavement and get you into that room to get the job.
What about the people, Matt, who work with the writers? This isn't just the writers who are not, or maybe they're working, but maybe are affected by all of this. There are the assistants who are a part of this process as well, who have also been sort of beholden to these big talent agencies as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's an entire economy around these writers that are fueled by the talent agencies, but there are assistants, there are people that are designated by the agencies to find material for their clients to adapt. And what we're seeing now in certain cases is that the agencies are taking that material and attaching producers and directors and actors, and they're doing it without a writer. So if you have a hot podcast, let's say, that some studio would want to adapt into a TV show, traditionally you would get a writer attached to that to adapt it. But what some of the agencies are doing now is they're assembling a filmmaker or a star and a piece of IP like a podcast, and they're selling that as a package and not including the writer. Maybe if the studio wants to bring on a writer, they can do that, obviously, after the fact. But the agency itself is excluding the writers from that process because the writers are not allowing them to do it.
And we're seeing it. The one example was Kate McKinnon, right, from Saturday Night Live. And what is it? Heads Will Roll.
Absolutely. I mean, this is another example of a hot piece of material with an actor that UTA, one of the agencies, was packaging. Before this standoff, they would have gone to one of their top clients, maybe Steve Levitan, who co-created Modern Family or something, somebody like that, to say, hey, would you like to be a part of this as the writer? And that's not happening now. So arguably, the writers are being left out. Now, down the line, obviously, you can't make a scripted TV show without writers, so they will have to be hired. But the value of the talent agency, it has traditionally been to bring you material, help you get that job, and put you in the position where you are treated the best way possible. And now that writer is not part of that process. Sometimes.
Do we see, Matt, like some of these studios, because there's this, you know, big brouhaha in the middle of the, you know, between the WGA and all the talent agencies, do we see that these studios are now maybe deferring and not even wanting scripted, or obviously scripted television, but and movies, but also maybe the originality, you know, the original stuff that people are looking for. Maybe they're going to try it and true things that don't need as much writing going into it.
Well, that's been happening for years. It depends on the outlet, but a lot of the networks and streaming services are looking for big pre-branded franchise material. But because of the content boom, as we call it, there is an opportunity here for new voices to come along and create something that, you know, comes out of nowhere. If you look at what happened with Fleabag this past year, with Phoebe Waller-Bridge winning all the Emmys. That's a show that was originated in the UK based on a one-woman play, and it created a sensation, and then two seasons in, it wins the top Emmy for comedy. Things like that are still happening, but I think that the the franchisization of television is happening in many ways.
What's going on with the negotiations? Are we any closer to seeing some sort of agreement, do you think? Or is this standoff just going to continue?
Depends who you talk to. I have heard lately that some of the smaller agencies have begun to say, you know what, enough's enough. And we've seen a few of them sign. You know, these are the smaller agencies that don't do a lot of packaging and producing. So they're much more inclined to agree to the guild's code of conduct. Where we haven't seen much headway made is with the bigger companies, because WME, CAA, UTA, they have made packaging and production a big part of their growth strategy. Endeavor Content, which is a division of Endeavor, a sister company of WME, I know this gets complicated, but that's a huge growth area and a huge priority for this company, which is trying to go public. They want to own these shows. They don't want to just be agents for hire.
Matt Bellany, editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. You can hear him on The Business with Kim Masters on Mondays here at KCRW. Matt, thank you.
No problem.
Well, today is Tuesday. Tomorrow is Corita Day in Los Angeles. And just ahead, we'll remember LA's sister Mary Corita and her art more than a century after her birth. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Tomorrow is Corita Day in Los Angeles, named by the city and the county, for that matter, after Sister Corita, a Catholic nun from the Order of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. But Sister Corita was also an artist, and for 30 years, she taught art and eventually chaired the art department at Immaculate Heart College. Tomorrow would have been her 101st birthday. And to talk about Sister Corita, we have someone whom we usually talk about transportation issues, but today she wants to talk about this very special woman, Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed LA. Hi, Alyssa.
Hey, Steve.
So the city and the county deemed tomorrow Corita Day.
Yes, full coverage, regional coverage.
You're a big fan of hers. What is it about her that made you so, you know, like have so much zeal to talk about Sister Corita?
Well, Sister Corita's work kind of checks all my aesthetic boxes, right? So we have this very vibrant, playful, almost fluorescent colored posters mostly with these layers of text and imagery. And so that part's cool enough. But then if you live here in LA, you start to look at some of the images she used and you start to see these little snippets that are pulled from our street life. She took pictures walking around the city. So you have freeway signage and like car dealership ads and little posters from like markets and strip malls. And so all of that kind of helped me appreciate LA's maybe undersung beauty, perhaps.
She was a nun and she taught art at a Catholic college for women. And yet she attracted some big name artists and designers into her world back in the 1960s. A very tumultuous time, obviously, in this country, here in Los Angeles as well. Buckminster Fuller, Charles and Ray Eames, John Cage, Alfred Hitchcock, obviously the famous director. What was it that drew those people into her orbit?
Well, the school had this very famous screen printing studio, and that alone got her a lot of visitors. People who were fans, like the Eameses, came to see how she worked. But they also did a lot of things at the college, at the school, that brought what she was doing out into the community. So they had a speaker series with a lot of these famous men that you mentioned, all men. They had these giant events called Mary's Day, where they would create these temporary artworks out on the lawn. So imagine like driving by in the 60s and seeing all these nuns and all these women, these students come spilling out onto the lawn, carrying cardboard boxes and signs and banners. And it was really just a really cool way to bring what they were doing to the neighborhood.
What kind of art are we talking about? Because you say bright fluorescent, you see some of the posters today even that incorporate some of her work. Was it political in nature? Was it, I mean, I think of the 60s, I think of politics.
Well, it started out as more religious, right? So you'd see Bible verses quoted and a lot of references to God and Jesus. And then you're right, over time, she began to use what was a, you know, becoming a big platform to convey some of these more social and political messages. And what she started doing is she would literally take the headlines of the day, things about the Vietnam War or things that happened in the civil rights movement, and she would cut up the newspapers, these very, you know, iconic front pages of newspapers we would see, and print them into posters and just crank them out, you know, overnight. And they would, you know, be placed in places where people would get to see her work. That it was very timely.
And obviously delving into politics as a nun, you're probably going to get into some trouble, right?
She got into some trouble. Yeah. So our archdiocese here in LA was very conservative. But overall, the Vatican at the time was going through a lot of changes. There was a political, you know, revolution happening within the church as well. So what happened was the nuns wanted a bigger role in the church. They couldn't hold many leadership positions. And they also wanted to incorporate more elements of secular life. They felt like wearing normal clothes instead of the habit might help them relate to the people that they were trying to serve. So the Pope convened a council, this was known as Vatican II, and ended up making the church more public-facing, much like what Carita was doing there. But locally, that didn't go over so well, and they called her blasphemous, they called her a communist,
ship turns very right. slowly, right?
You go from liberal to communist, yeah. And a lot of nuns ended up leaving the order because of some of the things that happened locally.
Leaving as protest, we have to distance ourselves.
Yes, and she did as well. She left as well.
She left the order and then she moved to Boston. She kept making art though, right? This was at her heart.
Yes, it literally her heart. This was when she made what might have been her most famous work of art. And I say, even if you don't know Carita's work, you would definitely know the stamp that she designed. It's just a very simple love written in her signature script that she always, her handwriting. And then there's this very, abstract heart underneath it. And this became kind of her logo in a way for the Carita Art Center and many other things that she did. And also in Boston, there's a very famous water tower that she painted with the same, you know, big brush arcing, colorful brush strokes. And even a lot of people in Boston just know that, but they don't know the rest of what she's done.
The Immaculate Heart College, where she taught, closed back in 1980, and most of the other nuns left the order, as you mentioned, when Sister Carita did. So that order closed down too. But the high school, the Immaculate Heart High School, is still there at the corner of Franklin and Western. There's an art school that's named after her, another thing named after Sister Carita. So she is still remembered in L.A.
She's remembered, but I think her legacy is limited to people who are maybe artists or designers. She was a woman during a very heavily male pop art movement, so that might be another reason she is not as well known. And you can go to the Art Center. You can go see the archives. They're in a very narrow hallway. Only 5 people are allowed in at a time to see everything. And, you know, it's at the entrance to Griffith Park, like you mentioned. It's, you know, very close to places we have wildfires, you know, there could be water damage from some of these older buildings. So there needs to be a plan to protect her work, to make these archives, bring these archives out into the community, like what she did. I mean, she had a storefront where she made an art gallery where anyone could come visit, even if they didn't want to come up to the school or to the church. So she needs to have that storefront again, maybe on Hollywood Boulevard. She needs like a star on the Walk of Fame. I mean, that's what a big deal she is.
It's such a big deal that you actually paid homage in your own personal and familial way.
I did. My husband and I met when we lived around the corner from where, you know, she had spent her life teaching. And when it came time to name our daughter, we made her middle name Carita to just honor the contributions that she made to our own lives and change the direction of our careers. She made a very profound impact on how we work and how we relate to the city. So my daughter wants to be an artist. So maybe someday I'll be able to take her to this place where she'll be able to physically experience, you know, what a wonderful person that Sister Carita was and what the impact that her namesake had on LA.
And by the way, I can vouch for that she wants to be an artist. She brings the crayons and the markers when you bring her in sometimes.
That's right. She's always learning from the best.
It's always a lot of fun. And here we are paying homage to her on what would be tomorrow, her 101st birthday.
That's right.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor, Curbed, and Greater LA contributor. Alyssa, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
By the way, Carita Day is going to be a wet day in Los Angeles. The first measurable rain of the season. We are in wet season for sure. And we could get about a half inch of rain in Southern California around the Los Angeles area. So be aware of that. There is flooding risk, especially in the recent fire burn areas, the Barham Fire and the Getty Fire we've had that were recently. Of course, a lot of the vegetation burned and a lot of those roots just not holding the soil. So that's a possibility. We could see snow down to 7, maybe even 6,000 feet, anywhere from a half a foot to a foot of snow. Be aware of that. The roads will be wet. They haven't been wet for a while. So if you're driving on those roads, do take that in mind, obviously, because oil on that road mixes with the rain, the wet rain, and, well, rain, of course, is wet, but, of course, that could make you slide around on the road. All right, I'm done with weather on that. Temperatures in the 60s, by the way, for tomorrow. That is our show for today. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow, it was a freeway that got halfway built. Caltrans killed the 710, but what about all those houses that it bought? Next on KCRW, it's DNA with Francis Anderton. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. And for your ears. Have a great Tuesday.